Religion and death dominated this Supreme Court term, a term that once again saw a remarkably high percentage of 5-4 decisions. This was also Chief Justice William Rehnquist's 30th year on the court, and it was in many ways a triumphant one for him, as he steered the court majority, albeit a narrow one, to positions that he once advocated alone. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1973, when William Rehnquist was a rookie justice in his first full term on the Supreme Court, the court declared that even small grants to parents of children in religious schools were a violation of the constitutional wall separating church and state. Justice Rehnquist, the court's newest member, dissented. Last week, with no other justice on the court remaining from that 1973 term, Rehnquist, now Chief Justice, announced the last decision of this term, in which he and four other justices laid out a new interpretation of the Constitution that vindicates his original vision. Writing for the court majority, Rehnquist upheld a Cleveland school voucher program that paid thousands of dollars to parents sending their children to religious private schools. The program, he said, did not violate the Constitution's bar to establishing religion because it was applied neutrally to all comers and offered parents what he called true choice. The court's turnaround on aid to religious schools was mainly the result of a change in the court's membership, from predominantly liberal to predominantly conservative. But it was also the result of skilled advocacy both inside and outside the court, and, contends University of Chicago professor David Strauss, it was the result of a change in political climate, in which vouchers are no longer such a popular idea.
One thing that might have influenced the court is the feeling that the political process can really handle this question pretty well, and we won't see a large-scale funneling of money to religious schools because the political process won't allow it.
Harvard Law professor Charles Fried, who served as Solicitor General in the Reagan administration, sees the situation now facing the body politic as the opposite of the situation created by the court's abortion decisions.
Roe v. Wade and Casey have more or less taken the prohibition of abortion or serious limits on abortion off the political table. This puts vouchers on the political table in the way that they have not quite been until now.
And UCLA's Eugene Volokh sees the voucher decision as a big boost for vouchers.
As a political matter, there's going to be a lot more pressure for school choice.
Volokh acknowledges that some state constitutions will likely forbid the use of vouchers anyway, but he adds that will set up a conflict with the federal constitution that the Supreme Court will likely have to resolve eventually.
I think in the next several years, the Supreme Court will have to confront this question and decide whether a state even may exclude religion or whether that is unconstitutionally discriminatory.
Stanford Dean Kathleen Sullivan sees the voucher decision as a dramatic departure from what has been the status quo. She sees the court's justification of true choice by individuals as something of a sham since, as she observes, the court would not allow public money to be used by parents sending their children to racially discriminatory schools. Rather, she says, for the court majority,
the key to their decision is they think religion should have a place at the table in public life with other similar secular institutions. And if that's the principle this court has adopted, then money could just as easily flow through the president's faith-based initiatives directly to the religious institutions.
Unlike the voucher case, this term's death penalty cases, one outlawing the death penalty for the retarded, the other requiring juries, not judges, to make the decision on the death sentence, found Chief Justice Rehnquist in the minority. Most scholars agree that while no justice on the current court would vote to abolish the death penalty entirely, the atmospherics have changed recently. Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger.
I think the shock to the system, and indeed to individual justices, has been the knowledge that so many people who were cleared by DNA evidence had been on death row.
Harvard professor Charles Fried.
They live in this world, and in this world there is a growing unease about the death penalty, and the DNA doubts are part of that unease.
Or as Yale law professor Akhil Amar puts it,
we used to be able to tell ourselves we have so many safeguards in place, and now all of our noses in America are being rubbed in it. We're really seeing day after day, you know, with every new newspaper account, situations where the system failed.
Two decisions this term could have significant impact on the lives of everyday Americans. The first was a 5-4 decision that upheld a state law that allowed patients to demand an independent review of HMO decisions denying medical treatment. The second was the court's 5-4 decision upholding drug testing for public school students as a condition for participating in extracurricular activities. Stanford Dean Kathleen Sullivan.
The real holding of the case is that children are different, and all the usual rules about privacy in public settings are off when it comes to minors.
Scholars of all political stripes note that the High Court has one almost unadulterated love, and that is free speech. Catholic University Dean Douglas Kamek.
In many ways, speech prevailed over everything. Speech prevailed over privacy. Speech prevailed over concerns about child pornography.
And speech prevailed over concerns about judicial independence. The justices, again by a 5-4 vote, struck down a typical state law barring judicial candidates for election from commenting on issues that might come before them as judges. As Stanford's Kathleen Sullivan sees it, the ruling could foreshadow the court's eventual ruling on the McCain-Feingold campaign reform bill.
That's probably a predictor of the basic lineup we're going to see on campaign finance reform issues.
And if it is, it will once again mark a triumph of the Rehnquist point of view that money is a form of speech and cannot be restricted. The Chief Justice has also succeeded in the last decade in reviving the notion of states' rights and limiting congressional power over the states. Perhaps most of all, he has championed the idea of state sovereignty and immunity to lawsuits from citizens. This year, he assigned Justice Clarence Thomas to write a decision that made it easier for states to thwart federal regulators. For the first time, the court made it impossible for citizens to bring states to account in federal agency administrative hearings. Catholic Law School Dean Douglas Kamek.
That's a startling development. In fact, it is now a pretty sizable limit on federal executive authority and not just federal judicial authority, and that's what makes it remarkable.
As Kamek observes, the conservative court majority is going back to some of the issues the Civil War was fought over.
It was fought over state authority versus federal authority. And where we would have one federal uniform voice and one federal uniform remedy, and where we would have many. The respective authority of state and federal governments remains very much in play in this court and very much the hallmark of the Rehnquist Court.
But Duke Professor Walter Dellinger, who served as Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, sees federalism as only a secondary legacy for this court.
To me, the most profound historical legacy of the Rehnquist Court will not be the revival of federalism, but the establishment of judicial supremacy over the Constitution. The irony here is that the court believes strongly in states' rights when the federal regulator is Congress, but when the federal regulator is the court itself, the court really shows no such solicitude for the state. States' rights, in other words, limits Congress, but it doesn't limit the court.
Whatever you call it, judicial imperialism, federalism, conservative activism, the court's agenda hangs on a slender thread. More than one out of four court decisions this term was by a 5-4 vote. Indeed, the majority of the most significant decisions were by that margin. As Supreme Court advocate Tom Goldstein puts it,
so a single vote, one way or the other, is going to change what the rule of law is.
And that is why the next time there's a Supreme Court vacancy, the confirmation battle is likely to be bloody.